Penguin Random House Audio presents Uncertain Ground, Citizenship in an Age of Endless Invisible War by Phil Clay. Read for you by Josh Casaubon. Introduction. In 2009, when the global war on terror was in its eighth year, twice as long as America spent fighting World War II, a high school student named Javier J. Gutierrez headed off to the army. Like I had been, he was young and idealistic and full of faith in America and in God. It was his sense of calling from his heavenly father that he pursued the military life, his obituary would one day read. And upon graduating from basic training, the newly minted 18-year-old private had put on his uniform and gone to the hospital to visit his great-grandfather, a bombardier in the Army Air Forces, who'd been shot down and taken prisoner by the Nazis. The old man, a veteran of our most celebrated military triumph, could no longer talk. Still, he had wept at the sight. I was leaving the Marine Corps then, and though I was only 25, the youth of new Marines and soldiers started getting to me. Baby-faced children heading out on deployments, coming back a little harder, leaner, but kids nonetheless. The protective eyewear they'd used on deployment would create ridiculous tan lines around their eyes, leaving them looking like a pack of scruffy, underfed raccoons. Back in 2009, I was still hopeful about the missions we were sending those kids out on. The surge of troops to Iraq that I'd been a part of had succeeded in lowering the level of violence there, and President Barack Obama was pushing for a similar strategy in Afghanistan. Maybe things really would wind down soon. And so, as I started writing about the war and the people who fight it, I envisioned my task primarily as making sense of the past. But the global war on terror, begun in Afghanistan and Iraq, but soon expanding to Syria and Somalia and Pakistan and the Philippines, wouldn't stay behind me. Unlike Gutierrez's father's war, which ended with the declaration of a ceasefire and the liberation of Kuwait on February 28, 1991, and his great-grandfather's war, which ended on September 2, 1945, my war just kept going. Gutierrez would serve in Iraq, get married, and have four kids in between deployments and training exercises. He joined the 7th Special Forces Group, an elite unit intended to focus on Latin America, but which has sent Green Beret teams on an endless series of deployments to Afghanistan. There he'd meet Antonio Rodriguez, who had also joined the military out of high school in 2009, and who was heading out on his 10th deployment to Afghanistan in as many years. During the two men's decade in service, the wars would warp and change. Instead of large numbers of troops, we shifted to smaller deployments of highly specialized forces, buttressed by the support of mercenaries and military contractors, who in some places outnumbered active duty troops 3-1. This kept casualties low. So on February 8, 2020, Gutierrez and Rodriguez would become the last American soldiers to fall in combat prior to the final, tragic evacuation. The men received heroes' burials back in their hometowns. Schoolchildren in Las Cruces, New Mexico, lined the street and waved flags across from the church holding Rodriguez's funeral mass. Police and firefighters stood at attention as the casket passed, hundreds of community members joining in the mourning. You can watch videos online of the broad turnout at Gutierrez's funeral, including, if you can stand the sadness of it, footage of his wife and four small children receiving the flag from his casket. His obituary notes that he lived sacrificially for his family. Outside of their hometowns, though, the deaths received hardly any notice from a public whose interest in the global war on terror had vanished years before. That indifference had become emblematic of the wars the two men fought in, as was the nature of their deaths, which didn't come while raiding a compound or hitting an improvised explosive device, but when an American-trained Afghan soldier turned his American-supplied machine gun on American backs. A final irony was their mission at the time, a key leader engagement in Nangarhar province. Yet another attempt, 20 years into the war, to win allies among the locals. How to speak meaningfully of a conflict that has lasted so long and at such a low ebb that most Americans can pretend it isn't happening. No one cares if Americans aren't being killed, the journalist Jonah Goldberg recently argued, nor should they care if Americans aren't being killed. As far as public opinion goes, he's largely right. And yet, whether or not war still captures the attention of the public, it still captures the attention of the Defense Department, which continues long-running and extremely lethal campaigns in various theaters of conflict. We may not be losing as many soldiers as we used to, since our role in wars has shifted to one of training, support, and the provision of air power and high-tech know-how, but we're certainly killing plenty of people. Nor are the dead and injured just members of terrorist groups. In 2020, so blissfully low in U.S. casualties in Afghanistan, the UN has tracked 120 civilian casualties that can be directly tied to international security forces. This somewhat understates our lethal presence in the region. The U.S. trained and supplied Afghan Air Force caused a further 693 civilian casualties, while the Afghan security forces as a whole caused 1,906. When they died, Afghanistan was a deadlier place for civilians than when Gutierrez and Rodriguez were graduating high school. And though we have removed our ground troops, our lethal presence remains in the skies above. In the same speech where President Biden claimed to have ended 20 years of war, he announced, "We will maintain the fight against terrorism in Afghanistan and other countries by relying on over-the-horizon capabilities instead of ground troops." The war was over, supposedly, but not the killing. What this means in practice is not simply children losing parents who lived sacrificially for their families, but also, since Afghanistan is one of the deadliest places in the world to be a child, parents losing children. The most recent UN report on civilian casualties in Afghanistan quotes the father of a boy killed in September 2020 by an explosive remnant of war. A bomb fragment left behind by one side or the other. He remembers hearing children screaming, "Please help us," then seeing his son and four others, all grievously wounded. "I took my son," he said. There was blood all over his body. Stomach, heart, and lungs had all been pierced, wounds that meant death within minutes. The father took water and tried to clean the injuries. "When he died," the man said, "he was looking toward me, straight into my eyes, unable to speak." So yes, even though in America we're swaddled from the consequences, we're still at war. Wherever we're regularly killing, we're at war. Which leads to the increasingly complex question of where we're killing people. Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and Libya, for those places the answer is certainly yes. Brian Kastner, a former explosive ordnance disposal tech, now at Amnesty International, tells me, "I can give you strike by strike in Somalia because the military at least acknowledges those strikes." But then there are other countries he describes as a true black box, like Niger, Mali, and Nigeria. "We know when U.S. soldiers die in Niger," he says. "We don't know when the U.S. kills people in Niger." Talking about American wars then increasingly becomes like talking about Schrodinger's cat. Outside the closed black boxes of our military involvement overseas, the American public remains blissfully at peace until an American dies, and it turns out we were at war all along. No wonder we've turned inward, especially when images of conflict can strike much closer to home, like the death of another veteran, Ashley Babbitt, one that happened in far less honorable and even more darkly tragic circumstances. Babbitt, who served two tours of duty in Afghanistan, was one of a disturbingly large number of veterans present at the storming of the U.S. Capitol building on January 6, 2021. After having previously voted for Barack Obama, she became a Trump supporter and follower of the QAnon conspiracy theory, ultimately joining the crowd that broke into the Capitol, beating and injuring police officers, and storming the halls of Congress only moments after the chambers had been evacuated. "Nothing will stop us," she had written in a social media post the day before. "They can try and try and try, but the storm is here and it is descending upon D.C. She was shot while climbing onto a ledge near a locked door the insurrectionists were trying to get through. This video can also be found online.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?